You're listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Disabled. Welcome to today's reading of the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for Monday, April 8th, 2024. I'm Fiona from Drake University. Here is our first story. This story is from the front page of the newspaper. It's titled, Two Local Clubs Go on First Avenue Walk for National Walking Week. Last week was National Walking Week, and walking clubs from both sides of the river came together to celebrate the occasion Thursday morning. Walk the Bluffs, also known as the Council Bluffs Community Walking Club, joined up with members of the Nebraska Wander Froon Trailblazers at the First Avenue Trail. The city of Council Bluffs recently unveiled four new murals, all of which can be seen from the trail, and the clubs got to see some public art while walking around 3 miles. Carrie McDonald, owner of First Row Fitness and Walk the Bluffs organizer, said the Trailblazers contacted her last year to try and set up a group walk, and her club's first walking session of the season, lining up with National Walking Week, seemed like the perfect time to collaborate. They wanted to see the new murals put up along the First Avenue Trail, she said. It was great. It turned out to be a beautiful day. McDonald started Walk the Bluffs a year ago with the simple mission of getting people on their feet for their health, while also getting to know other members of the community. She said she noticed many familiar faces from last year, and it was exciting hosting the Trailblazers to give them a taste of Council Bluffs' robust trails system. The Nebraska Wander Froon Trailblazers group was formed in 1979, and it's one of the first clubs entered into the American Volksport Association. Trailblazers president Lori Anderson said her club's goal is to provide fun, fitness, and friendship to its members. McDonald said that while not everyone can handle strenuous exercise, the simple act of walking provides numerous benefits. It's all about movement and getting our heart rate up, she said. If we go on a handful of 20-minute walks within our week and push ourselves to a pace where we feel like we're breathing a little harder, we're going to reap the benefits of that movement. The American Heart Association says 150 minutes of brisk walking per week can lead to improved physical and mental health. Walking helps reduce the risk of diseases like heart disease, stroke, diabetes, and different cancers. It also improves blood cholesterol, blood pressure, and blood sugar, while increasing energy and stamina. Boosted bone strength and weight gain prevention are other benefits. As far as mental health, the association says walking improves memory and reduces the risk of dementia, and it also strengthens mental and emotional well-being. The next Walk the Bluffs session will take place on the Riverfront Trail system at 10:45 a.m. on Saturday, April 13th. Walkers will meet at the edges at Tom Hannafin River's Edge Park. Walk the Bluffs meets every Saturday at Trails Inn and around the city. Every walk is an hour long and starts at 10:45 a.m. The group also hosts monthly hikes. These are 90 to 120 minutes long and start at 9 a.m. The schedule with times can be found on Walk the Bluffs Facebook group. And there's several pictures associated with this story here, so I'm going to go through a couple of them. On the front page, one of them is titled, Members of the Council Bluffs Community Walking Club in the Nebraska Wander Froon's Trailblazers hike along the First Avenue Trail, and it has a picture of probably about 20 people walking along the street. There's a picture next to it that's captioned, artist Weston Thompson's mural Dream Builder is seen in the background as members of the Council Bluffs Community Walking Club and the Nebraska Wander Froon Trailblazers hike along the First Avenue Trail. And again, you can see about 5 people going on a walk here. They're all dressed in coats. It looks like it's a little chilly and windy outside. And you can see that mural in the background. There's another picture of more people walking in front of the mural. It's a mural of sunflowers, and there's a couple bees in there. It's really pretty. And then over on the second page of the story, there's several more pictures of people walking with the Des Moines skyline in the background, the Omaha skyline, and then you can see a couple more murals, and there's a couple pictures of people walking their dogs in front of the murals, so that's sweet. This next story is also from the front page. It's titled, Many Iowans Face Loss of Key Internet Subsidy. It's by Caleb McCullough. Tens of thousands of Iowans are set to lose a monthly stipend for internet access at the end of April if Congress does not approve more funding. That funding loss would put their connection to vital services like healthcare and work opportunities at risk. The Affordable Connectivity Program, created in the American Rescue Plan Act in 2021, provides $30 a month for low-income Americans to help pay their internet bill and $75 in tribal regions. But that money will run out at the end of April, and Congress has not approved a proposal to replace the funding. More than 124,000 Iowa households are receiving the monthly stipend to help pay for their internet access, according to data from the White House. The program has provided more than $68 million to those households over the last 2 years. While the $1.2 trillion government funding package passed by federal lawmakers in March did not include extra funding for the program, a bipartisan group of lawmakers has introduced legislation to keep it funded throughout the end of the year. The bill, which would devote $7 billion to the program, has 221 co-sponsors in the U.S. House and 3 sponsors in the Senate, but experts are skeptical that it will have the support to become law. None of Iowa's members of Congress, who are all Republicans, have signed on to the proposal. President Joe Biden's administration is pushing for more funding for the program, calling it a vital lifeline for vulnerable families and a key effort to, quote, narrow the digital divide. In a press call with reporters this week, Stephen Benjamin, a senior advisor to Biden, called on House Republicans to fund the program before it runs out in April. If congressional Republicans fail to act, 23 million Americans, including millions of their own constituents, will lose access to affordable, high-speed internet and may not be able to access the benefits it brings, Benjamin said. The program was open to families with an income of less than 200% of the federal poverty line, or around $62,400 for a family of four. It stopped accepting applications in February, and April will be the last full month of funding. Enrollees may receive a partial stipend in May, but without a congressional fix, the benefit will end this spring. Some enrolled members may lose access. The impact of the program shutting for Iowa families will be significant, said Community Action Broadband Network co-founder Curtis Dean. The organization works on digital equity in Iowa and other states, working with community providers to improve internet access. Once the funding runs out, the tens of thousands of Iowans enrolled in the program would need to switch to a cheaper plan, cut spending on other necessities, or end their internet access entirely, Dean said. It's unclear how many people enrolled in the program will be unable to afford any home internet connection, Dean said, but he said he thinks there will be some Iowans who lose their service. We'd all like to hope that the vast majority of those enrollees figure out another way to keep their internet service so they can stay part of the digital economy and not have to go back on the other side of the digital divide, Dean said. But I think it's inevitable we're going to see some people fall through the cracks. There are other programs enrolled Iowans can access to help fill in the gaps, but none are as generous as the ACP. The Federal Communications Commission has a lifeline program that provides families with an income of less than 135% of the poverty line with a $9.25 a month stipend for either a phone or internet bill if their provider participates in the program. The large investment in broadband access in the last few years, including the ACP, was partially motivated by the pandemic pushing important daily necessities online. Students attending school virtually sometimes resorted to school and restaurant parking lots to complete schoolwork, said Dean, and some families will likely have to return to that. We're going to see that parking lot in the schools and libraries for kids doing homework is going to come back now, he said. And we are going to, again, be asking our public institutions like libraries, like schools, to pick up the slack for the inaction by our leadership to be able to restore funding for ACP. One rural internet provider is optimistic that all its customers will be able to keep access after the federal benefit ends. Muscatine Power and Water, a nonprofit offering fiber internet in Muscatine and Fruitland, has about 200 customers that are enrolled in the program, said Erica Cox, Director of Customer and Technology Experience. Most of those customers were already receiving service through the utility before the program began, but some customers were able to receive internet service for the first time because of the stipend, Cox said. Cox also said the pandemic elevated the need for a reliable internet connection, and the program has helped Muscatine community members participate in the digital economy. We used to think of it maybe just for entertainment, but it's well beyond that, she said. It's for kids to be able to do their schoolwork. It's for people to be able to work from home. Even people are doing healthcare through home now. Muscatine Power and Water has informed enrolled customers of the upcoming end of the program, and Cox said she expects those customers will be able to keep access and switch to a more affordable plan if needed. Still, she said she is hopeful that Congress will be able to pass more funding for the program. We're hopeful that maybe through some additional consideration of the plan, that maybe there will be some additional government funding of it going forward, she said. And back on the front page of this story, there's a picture. It's captioned, President Joe Biden speaks January 18th in Raleigh, North Carolina. 23 million families will either have to pay for more internet or cancel their subscriptions altogether if a federal subsidy program to help with the monthly bill runs out of money in April. And pictured, you can see President Biden speaking to a crowd in front of a microphone. There's several signs that say Raleigh, North Carolina, affordable high-speed internet, and investing in America. This next story is from the Nation and World section. It's titled, Israel Pulls Some Troops. Israel's military announced Sunday it had withdrawn its forces from the southern Gaza city of Khan Yunis, wrapping up a key phase in its ground offensive against the Hamas militant group and bringing its troop presence in the territory to one of the lowest levels since the six-month war began. But defense officials said troops were merely regrouping as the army prepares to move into Hamas's last stronghold, Rafah. The war in Gaza continues, and we are far from stopping, said the military chief, Lieutenant General Herzi Halabi. Local broadcaster Channel 13 TV reported that Israel was preparing to begin evacuating Rafah within 1 week, and the process could take several months. Still, the withdrawal was a milestone as Israel and Hamas marked 6 months of fighting. Military officials, speaking on condition of anonymity under army policy, said a, quote, significant force remained in Gaza to continue targeted operations, including in Khan Yunis, a Hamas stronghold and hometown of the group's leader, Yahya Sinwar. AP video in Khan Yunis on Sunday showed some people returning to a landscape marked by shattered multi-story buildings and climbing over debris to explore crumbled, dusty remains. Cars were overturned and charred. Southern Gaza's main hospital, Nasser, was in shambles. Israel for weeks has vowed a ground offensive in nearby Rafah, but the city shelters some 1.4 million people, more than half of Gaza's population. The prospect of an offensive has raised global alarm, including from Israel's top ally, the U.S., which has demanded to see a credible plan to protect civilians. Allowing people to return to nearby Khan Yunis could relieve some pressure on Rafah. White House National Security spokesman John Kirby repeated on Sunday the U.S. opposition to a Rafah offensive and told ABC the U.S. believes that the partial Israeli withdrawal, quote, is really just about rest and refit for these troops that have been on the ground for 4 months and not necessarily that we can tell indicative of some coming new operation for these troops. Israel's military quietly drew down troops in devastated northern Gaza earlier in the war, but it has continued to carry out airstrikes and raids in areas where it says Hamas has resurfaced, including Gaza's largest hospital, Shifa, leaving what the head of the World Health Organization called, quote, an empty shell. The six-month mark has been met with growing frustration in Israel, where anti-government protests have swelled and anger is mounting over what some see as government inaction to help free about 130 remaining hostages, about a quarter of whom Israel says are dead. Hamas-led militants took about 250 captives when they crossed from Gaza into Israel on October 7th and killed 1,200 people, mostly civilians. The next story here is titled, Yellen Seeks to Strengthen Ties. U.S. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen sent a message of mutual cooperation at a meeting Sunday with Chinese Premier Li Qiang, highlighting the improvement in relations since her visit to China last year, while recognizing that major differences remain. After focusing on trade and economic issues for the first 2 days of her visit, Yellen turned to the broader U.S.-China relationship in the meeting with Li, one of China's top leaders. While we have more to do, I believe that, over the past year, we have put our bilateral relationship on more stable footing, she said. in the ornate Fujian room of the Great Hall of the People on the west side of Tiananmen Square. Yellen, who is regarded favorably in China, is the first cabinet member to visit since Presidents Joe Biden and Xi Jinping met in California in November in a carefully orchestrated meeting to set the troubled relationship between their countries on a better course. Li, in remarks before the media before their meeting, said the high media interest in Yellen's visit, quote, shows the high expectation they have, and also the expectation and hope to grow the U.S.-China relationship. China's emergence as an economic and military power has created a rivalry with the long-dominant United States. The U.S. has restricted China's access to advanced semiconductors and other technology, saying it could be used for military purposes. China, still a middle-income country, accuses the U.S. of trying to constrain its economic development. At their meeting, Li told Yellen that China hopes the U.S. won't politicize economic and trade issues or overstretch the definition of national security, the official Xinhua news agency said. Yellen came to China with trade practices that put American companies and workers at an unfair competitive disadvantage at the top of her agenda. Chinese government subsidies and other policy support have encouraged solar panel and EV makers in China to invest in factories, building far more production capacity than the domestic market can absorb. While that has driven down prices for consumers, Western governments fear that the capacity will flood their markets with low-priced exports, threatening American and European jobs. But Li argued that the development of the green energy industry in China would make an important contribution to combating climate change, the Xinhua report said. The U.S. and China on Saturday agreed to hold intensive exchanges on more balanced economic growth, according to a U.S. statement issued after Yellen and Chinese Vice Premier He Lifeng held extended meetings over 2 days in the southern city of Guangzhou. They also agreed to start exchanges on combating money laundering. It was not immediately clear when and where the talks would take place. As the world's two largest economies, we have a duty to our own countries and to the world to responsibly manage our complex relationship and to cooperate and show leadership on addressing pressing global changes, Yellen said. The next story in the section is called World Leaders Condemn Ecuador After Embassy Break-In. The global condemnation of Ecuador's government for its decision to break into the Mexican embassy snowballed Sunday, with more presidents and other leaders expressing disapproval, shock, and dismay. The criticism came as Mexico's ambassador and other personnel arrived in Mexico City on Sunday afternoon after departing Ecuador's capital, Quito, on a commercial flight. President Andre Manuel López Obrador severed diplomatic ties with Ecuador immediately after Friday's raid, which international law experts, presidents, and diplomats have deemed a violation of long-established international accords. Police broke through external doors of the Mexican embassy in Quito to arrest Jorge Glass, who has been living there since December. He sought asylum after being indicted on corruption charges. Mexico plans to challenge the raid at the World Court in The Hague. In a statement Sunday, the Spanish Foreign Ministry said the entry by force into the Embassy of Mexico in Quito constitutes a violation of the 1961 Vienna Convention on Diplomatic Relations. We call for respect for international law and harmony between Mexico and Ecuador, brotherly countries to Spain and members of the Ibero-American community. A day earlier, the Organization of American States, in a statement, reminded its members, which include Ecuador and Mexico, of their obligation not to invoke norms of domestic law to justify non-compliance with their international obligations. And then over in the digest section of the Nation and World section of the paper, there's a couple short stories I'm going to read through here. The first one's called Officials, Ukraine Fired on Nuclear Power Plant. The head of the UN's Atomic Watchdog Agency on Sunday condemned a drone strike on one of six nuclear reactors at the Russian-controlled Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant in Ukraine, saying such attacks significantly increased the risk of a major nuclear accident. In a statement on the social media platform X, Rafael Mariano Grossi confirmed at least three direct hits against the ZNPP main reactor containment structures took place. "This cannot happen," he said. According to the plant authorities, there was no critical damage or casualties, and radiation levels at the plant were normal after the strikes. Later on Sunday, however, Russian state-owned nuclear agency Rosatom said three people were wounded. The next short story is called Man Charged with Setting Fire Near Sanders' Office. A man was charged Sunday with setting a fire outside the Vermont office of U.S. Senator Bernie Sanders, federal prosecutors said. Shant Sagomian, age 35, who was previously of Northridge, California, entered the building on Friday and went to Sanders' third-floor office, where security video showed him spraying a liquid on the door and setting it afire, officials said. The building's interior surface suffered some damage from the fire and sprinkles that doused the area with water, but no one was hurt. Sanders, an independent, was not in the office at the time. And there's a couple stories called Briefly. The first one says, in China, China's military said Sunday that it conducted air and sea patrols and that all activities that disrupt the South China Sea are under control, an apparent response to naval exercises by the U.S. and its allies. There's one about gun death. It says, an eastern Pennsylvania man has been charged with involuntary manslaughter in the death of a three-year-old boy who authorities say shot himself with a handgun left unattended last month. Jose Hilario Abreu, age 28, of Allentown, was arraigned Friday on the charge, as well as two counts of child endangerment. The next story is titled Flooding. It says, Russia's government declared the situation in flood-hit areas in the Orenburg region a federal emergency on Sunday, with preparations for possible flooding underway in three other regions, state media reported. The floods, caused by rising water levels in the Ural River, forced over 4,000 people to evacuate in the Orenburg region. The next one's called Poland Elections. It says an exit poll released after Poland's local and regional elections Sunday showed Prime Minister Donald Tusk's pro-EU party trailing the conservative opposition party that governed Poland for 8 years until December. According to the poll, Law and Justice won 33.7% of votes and Tusk's Civic Coalition won 31.9%. The next short story is called Pakistan. It says, a motorcycle bomb killed two people and wounded five in Pakistan's southwest, a police official said Sunday. It's the latest unrest to hit Baluchistan province, where militants have tried to target a naval facility in recent weeks. And the final story, short story in this little section is titled Hardwood Flooring. It says, Pennsylvania-based AHF Products said it will purchase West Virginia's Allegheny Wood Products Sawmill in the Greenbrier County community of Smoot and the Randolph County community of Norton. AHF said in a statement that about 80 jobs will be saved at the two mills. And those are all the news stories from today's paper. So I'm going to flip back to the paper from yesterday, Sunday, April 7th, 2024, and read a couple news stories from there. This first one is called Ewing Suddenly Resigns as Children's Square President. The leader of a Council Bluffs-based nonprofit serving children and families in the metropolitan area unexpectedly stepped down Friday. Viv Ewing resigned as president and CEO of Children's Square USA, effective immediately on Friday morning. I have decided that it is time for me to move on to new challenges and support my family as we embark on new opportunities, Ewing said in a statement provided to the nonpareil. The Children's Square Board of Directors accepted Ewing's resignation on Friday morning and named Phil Taylor, the organization's chief administrative officer, as interim president and CEO. Taylor told the nonpareil in an email that he couldn't provide additional comment on the sudden timing of Ewing's departure. She had been at the helm of Children's Square since January 2022. It has been an honor and a privilege, Ewing said in a statement, noting she is immensely proud of the accomplishments during her tenure. Together, we have made significant strides in advancing our mission and serving our community. I want to express my gratitude to the board of directors, staff, volunteers, and supporters. Ewing is an Omaha native who has a doctorate from the University of Nebraska-Lincoln in Community and Human Resources, a master's degree in urban studies, and a bachelor's degree in public administration from the University of Nebraska at Omaha. She has more than 20 years of executive leadership with nonprofits, including as CEO of the Alzheimer's Association. She's previously worked for the now-defunct Promise Ship Habitat for Humanity, Salvation Army Croc Center, and Omaha Housing Authority. Taylor has deep roots with Children's Square, including as a volunteer in its emergency shelter and as a board chair from 2014 to 2016. He and his wife were foster parents and adopted their daughter through Children's Square. He started working for the nonprofit in August 2022. A native of Illinois, Taylor holds an Executive Master of Business Administration degree from the UNO. He was previously the general manager of the Nonpareil before serving as president of the Omaha World Herald. Before joining Children's Square, he was the vice president of sales and marketing and Omaha market president of Five Nines Technology Group. I am honored that the board has asked me to serve in this role, Taylor said in a news release. Children's Square provides critical services that bring healing and hope to children with mental and behavioral health needs. We will continue to provide services that make a positive impact on the lives of children and families in our community. The 141-year-old organization is based in Council Bluffs, with a presence in Omaha. It serves children with mental and behavioral health needs. Each day, it provides more than 1,000 youth and families receive counseling, emergency services, early childhood care, foster care, and residential treatment. And there's a picture with this story, too. It's captioned, Children's Square USA President and CEO Viv Ewing and other members of Leadership CB's 34th Class High Five Program alumni after being recognized during the Council Bluffs Area Chamber of Commerce's mid-year meeting and Leadership CB graduation at the Mid-America Center on June 8th, 2022. And you can see Viv giving a high five to one of the members there. There's a line of people standing up to give high fives to Viv Ewing there. This next story is titled, Guard Stays Busy Helping Out Vets. It's by Tim Rower. For many years now, the Canesville Riders Honor Guard has offered full military honors to veterans who have passed on. It has just reached a milestone. As of this Friday, we will have served 1,000 funerals, said its treasurer, Cindy Ruby. Her husband, Al Ruby, who is the group's president, added, No veteran should be buried without full military honors. Sanctioned by the U.S. Department of Defense to perform this service, the riders have traveled many miles for offering their final respects. We went to Kansas City, Kansas to do a funeral, Ruby said. If a veteran passes away, we will provide full military honors. In fact, we've done 3 to 4 funerals in a day. We never turn down a funeral. Canesville Riders Honor Guard performed this tribute at no charge. It offers other services too, including helping veterans struggling with post-traumatic stress disorder, which can bring on flashbacks, nightmares, severe anxiety, and other symptoms. Approximately 23% of veterans behind bars suffer from PTSD and don't know how to deal with it, Ruby said. Veterans dealing with PTSD can set up an appointment with a trained counselor at the Guard's headquarters at 3000 Avenue B in Council Bluffs. Here, veterans can come and be in a safe place, said Keith Confer, Vice President. And it's off the record. You have to learn to manage it. You have to have that push, added member Ed Kearns. This service is even available for Council Bluffs first responders, whether they are veterans or not, and city employees who are veterans, he said. Officials in the police and fire departments, as well as Council Bluffs Mayor Matt Walsh, have offered support for such services. Mayor Walsh has been a godsend to this group, Kern said. He understands what this group does. The counselor, Lyle Burkle, has been employed in the mental health field for more than 40 years, including working at the Omaha Veterans Administration Hospital. Another service, which has become an annual event, is accompanying veterans on a 3-day honor flight to view veterans' memorials in Washington, D.C. This year's honor flight, the group's fourth, is scheduled to begin October 1st. Currently, more than 60 veterans have signed up for this trip, Cindy Ruby said. This 3-day tour allows the veterans to view the sites in a relaxing, unrushed manner, she said. It's also totally free of charge for the veterans. It's a great experience, Cindy Ruby said. The group sponsors a gun show as a fundraiser and is always welcoming of donations to help support its mission. You don't have to pay to be a member, and you don't have to be a veteran to join, Cindy Ruby said. We need more support, Al Ruby said. Find more information on the group's website at CanesvilleHonorGuard.org. Canesville is K-A-N-E-S-V-I-L-L-E, HonorGuard.org, or through its Facebook page at facebook.com/CanesvilleWriters.HonorGuard. It's not about us, Al Ruby said. It's about what we do for other veterans. And then with this story, there's a picture. It's captioned, Ed Cairns displays the emblem of the Canesville Riders Honor Guard. Founded in 2014, this group provides multiple services to veterans and the loved ones. and you can see a picture of the flag. It's got a big circle in the middle with the American flag at the top. There's a couple different emblems from the different branches of the U.S. military, and then in the center, it looks like there's a statue holding a rock. You're listening to the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for Monday, April 8th on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped in Des Moines. I'm Fiona from Drake University. IRIS volunteers love to hear from listeners. If you have any comments or questions about this or any IRIS program, please call toll-free from anywhere in Iowa at 515-243-6833. Next, I'm going to flip over to the obituary section. It doesn't look like there are any for today, Monday, April 8th, or from yesterday, Sunday, April 7th. So I'm flipping back to the Saturday, April 6th paper for these obituaries. This first one's for Joan L. Bunton, who lived from September 14th, 1928 to April 2nd, 2024. Joan L. Bunton, aged 95, of Council Bluffs, passed away peacefully April 2, 2024, at Midlands Living Center. Joan was born September 14, 1928, in Council Bluffs, to the late Carl and Ann Eckert. She graduated from Abraham Lincoln High School in 1946 and earned her nursing degree from the Mercy Hospital School of Nursing in 1949. Joan married Richard Bunton on August 21, 1949. They were blessed with five children, Richard II, Deanne, Barbara, Susan, and Timothy. Joan worked at Mercy Hospital, taught nursing at IWCC for 18 years, and was the director of nursing at Bethany Lutheran Home Retiring in 1993. She was a member of St. Peter Catholic Church, St. Anne's Altar, and Rosary Society, Mercy Hospital alumni, and the Birthday Club. In addition to her parents, Joan was preceded in death by her husband, Richard Bunton, in 1996, son, Rick Bunton, in 2016, sister, Julie Eckert, brothers, James and Richard Eckert, and Joan is survived by her children, Deanne, married to Daryl Herwig, Barbara Booten, Susan, married to Tom Lorkovic, Tim, married to Cindy Bunton, her daughter-in-law, Verna Bunton, and 11 grandchildren, 16 grandchildren, her brother, Scott Eckert, and her nieces and nephews. Recitation of the Rosary, Monday, April 8th, 2024, at 6 p.m., followed by visitation with the family until 8 p.m., at Cutler O'Neill Meyer Woodring Bayless Park Chapel. Mass of Christian Burial, Tuesday, April 9th, 2024, at 10 a.m., at St. Peter Catholic Church, with a nurse tribute tendered by the Mercy Hospital Nurse Honor Guard. Interment, St. Joseph's Cemetery, with a lunch following at St. Peter Cotis Hall. Memorials are suggested to St. Peter Catholic Church or Midlands Living Center. The next obit is for Jack G. Mowry, who lived from from June 23, 1929 until April 2, 2024. Jack G. Mowry, aged 94, passed away peacefully at Midlands Living Center on April 2, 2024. He was born June 23, 1929, to William and Edna Mowry in Council Bluffs. Jack was a member of Plumbers Local 16 in addition to farming. He was a member of the Church of the Nazarene for over 65 years. In addition to his parents, Jack was preceded in death by his wife, Catherine, his siblings Vivian Garber, Lola James, Edward Mowry, George Mowry, Richard Mowry, Florence Thompson, William Mowry, and Peggy Simpson. Jack is survived by his children, John Mowry, Diana Coleman, and Dennis Mowry, special niece, Norma Jean Mass, grandchildren and great-grandchildren, nieces, nephews, and cousins. Visitation will be held from 3 to 5 p.m. at Hoy Kilnoski Funeral Home on Sunday, April 7, 2024. Funeral service will be held at 10 a.m. at Hoy Kilnoski Funeral Home on Monday, April 8, 2024. Interment will be in the Branson Cemetery. The family will direct memorials. The next obit here is for Wanda K. LaFleur, Charlotte. She was born June 8, 1948 and passed away April 3, 2024. Wanda K. LaFleur, age 75, of Las Vegas, Nevada, passed away peacefully in her home with her children by her side in the early morning hours of April 3, 2024. Wanda was preceded in death by her parent Irvin and May Charlotte and brother Leroy Charlotte. She is survived by her children, Tanya J. Fix of Las Vegas, Nevada, and Tim L. LaFleur of Annadel, Minnesota. Her brothers, Kenny and Brian Chollet, and her sister, Brenda Elliott, grandson, Eddie Bunnell of Columbia, Missouri, six grandchildren, two great-grandchildren, niece and nephews, family and friends. A celebration of life will be held on June 9th, 2024, at the McClellan Town Hall in McClellan, Iowa, from 11 a.m. until 2 p.m. Memorials to be handled by the family. And there's one last obituary here for this Saturday. It's for Marcia A. Gideon Rogers, who lived from March 15, 1937 until April 2, 2024. Of Council Bluffs, preceded in death by son Rodney, sister Carolyn Maxfield. Survived by her son Reed, married to Sandra. Daughter-in-law Karen Rogers. Granddaughters Sarah, Hannah. Nieces, nephews, family, and friends. Visitation Saturday, April 6th, 2024, from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. at Roeder Mortuary. And those are all the obituaries from this weekend. So I'm going to flip back to the paper for today, Monday, April 8th, to read the sports section. This first story is titled Perfect 10. Camila Cardoso delivered once again for Dawn Staley in South Carolina. A perfect finish, a dynasty. A team too big for Caitlin Clark in Iowa this time around. Cardoso had 15 points and a career-high 17 rebounds, and South Carolina completed its perfect season with an 87-75 victory over Clark and the Hawkeyes in the NCAA championship game on Sunday. With Staley directing a relentless attack from the sideline, the Gamecocks, going 38-0, became the 10th Division I team to go through a season without a loss. And they accomplished the feat after they lost all five starters from last season's team that lost to Clark's squad in the national semifinals. When young people lock in and have a belief and have a trust and their parents have that same trust, this is what can happen, Staley said. They make history. They etched their names in the history books. Clark did all she could to lead the Hawkeyes to their first championship. She scored 30 points, including a championship record 18 in the first quarter. She rewrote the record book at Iowa, going 34-5, finishing as the career-leading scorer in the NCAA Division I history with 3,951 points. She hopes her legacy isn't defined by falling short in two NCAA championship games, but more by the millions of new fans she helped bring into the game and the countless young girls and boys that she inspired. I think the biggest thing is it's really hard to win these things. I think I know that better than most people by now. To be so close twice really hurts, Clark said. As the final buzzer sounded, a stoic Clark walked off the court, through the confetti, and into the tunnel leading to the locker room. I personally want to thank Caitlin Clark for lifting up our sport. She carried a heavy load for our sport, Staley said. She's going to lift that league, the WNBA, up as well. Caitlin Clark, if you're out there, you're one of the goats of our game. We appreciate you. South Carolina has won three titles in the last 8 years, including two of the past three, to lay claim to being the latest dynasty in women's basketball. Staley became the fifth coach to win at least three national championships, joining Gino Arima, Pat Summitt, Kim Mulkey, and Tara Vanderveer. The Gamecocks, who have won 109 of their last 112 games, became the first team since UConn in 2016 to go undefeated. South Carolina had a couple scares throughout the season, but always found a way to win. With most of the team returning next year, Staley's team is in a good position to keep this run going. This team, we're going to be good. Coach Staley, we have the best coach, what, in the country, in the nation, in the whole wide world? Raven Johnson said. It's no telling what she's going to add to the pieces that's already here. I just say, be on the lookout. And at the top of the story, there's a picture here. It's captioned, South Carolina players celebrate at the end of Sunday's NCAA Women's National Championship game against Iowa in Cleveland. And you can see the players cheering, hugging. There's a basketball bouncing across the court, too. The next story is titled, UConn-Purdue Meet for Title. The NCAA tournament has reached its finish line, down to one game pairing the two best teams that routinely win in romps and boasting a marquee post-matchup that features a two-time National Player of the Year. Maybe that will make this version of March Madness something to remember after all. Reigning champion UConn meets Purdue on Monday night in a matchup of top seeds that have combined to win their first five tournament games by an average margin of 22.3 points. They have been at the center of a tournament lacking in drama, with its second highest average margin of victory since the field expanded to 64 teams in 1985, only one last-second winning shot, and few of the highlight reel thrills that have become a staple of the event. Don't expect the Huskies or Boilermakers to feel the least bit bothered by their dominance either. People that love basketball and people that really know the game, you watch good basketball, Purdue guard Fletcher Loyer said Sunday. Obviously, the upsets are fun and real cool, and they get attention. But real basketball, you like to see the two best teams go at it. And I think that's what we have here. And for those last-second shots that live on in tournament lore, the closest this year was KJ Simpson, rattling in a baseline jumper with 1.7 seconds left to lift Colorado past Florida 102-100 in round one. Everything else has largely been about UConn's run to greatness and Purdue's march to redemption from last year's stunning loss to 16th-seeded Fairleigh Dickinson. Once you get to this time of year, everything is just you are what your identity is, UConn coach Dan Hurley said. The way you play, it's very automatic. It just comes down to hoping that it's your night. The next story is from the MLB. It's called Pirates Slip Past O's After Wild Throw. There's a couple of short stories here about the MLB games. The first one's from Pittsburgh. It says, Baltimore Orioles shortstop Gunnar Henderson made a diving stop near second base on Edward Oliveira's grounder in a try for a game-ending double play and threw wildly past first, allowing two runs to score to give the Pittsburgh Pirates a 3-2 win on Sunday. Orioles starter Dean Kramer allowed an unearned run and five hits in seven innings with six strikeouts and no walks. With the wild win, the Pirates improved to 8-2 for the first time since 2018. The Braves and D-backs game, the Braves won 5-2. Michael Harris, too, hit a go-ahead homer in the fourth. Left-hander Chris Sale went 5 1/3 innings in his first home start for his new team, and Atlanta swept a three-game series with Arizona. Sale, acquired from the Boston Red Sox in an offseason trade for Vaughn Grissom, allowed two runs on four hits with no walks. Sale retired Arizona's first 10 batters before giving up two runs in the fourth when Christian Walker had a run-scoring single. Yankees and Blue Jays went 8-3. Giolanco Stanton hit a loud tie-breaking grand slam in the third, and New York beat visiting Toronto for its eighth victory in 10 games to start the season. The Astros and Rangers went 3-1. Ronald Blanco allowed one hit over six innings. Yordan Alvarez had a three-run homer, and Houston avoided getting swept by host Texas. The Nationals and Phillies went 3-2. Mackenzie Gore pitched five-hit ball into the sixth, and Washington beat visiting Philadelphia to avoid a three-game series sweep. The Brewers and Mariners went 12-4. William Contreras hit two home runs. Willie Adams also homered, and Milwaukee pounded visiting Seattle. Contreras finished with four hits and five RBIs. The Cubs and Dodgers went 8-1. Sade Manga allowed two hits and four shutout innings. Cody Bellinger homered against his former team, and host Chicago beat Los Angeles. The Mets and Reds went 3-1. Francisco Lindor ended an 0-for-24 skid with a homer. Sean Manea lowered his ERA to 0.82, and New York defeated host Cincinnati. The Royals and White Sox went 5-3. MJ Melendez hit his third home run of the series, a two-run drive in a three-run seventh as Kansas City rallied past visiting Chicago to complete a four-game sweep. The Giants and Padres went 3-2. Matt Chapman drove in two, including a go-ahead single in the eighth as San Francisco beat San Diego in front of its third straight home sellout, matching all of 2023. The Marlins and Cardinals went 10-3. Jazz Chisholm Jr. and Nick Gordon hit three-run homers in a six-run first, and Miami routed host St. Louis to end a nine-game skid. The Red Sox and Angels went 12-2. Chase McGuire had five RBIs, Tyler O'Neill hit his third homer of the series, and Boston routed LA to wrap up a 10-game trip. The Rays and Rockies went 3-2. Ryan Pepiot struck out a career-high 11 batters in six shutout innings, and Tampa Bay held on at Colorado. And finally, the Athletics and Tigers went 7-1. Zach Gelof had four hits, including a three-run homer, and drove in four runs to help Oakland beat host Detroit. This next story from the sports section is called Capping a Great Day at the Track. It's from NASCAR in Martinsville. William Byron took the lead with 73 laps to go and held on to it during a two-lap overtime finish Sunday to enhance Hendrick Motorsport's celebration of its 40-year anniversary of its first victory in racing with a victory in the NASCAR Cup Series at Martinsville Speedway. Byron, the first of the contenders to pit under a green flag with 104 laps to go, moved to the front 31 laps later and was never threatened after getting the jump at the start of overtime. It was his third win this season and his second on the 0.526-mile paperclip-shaped oval. He stayed on the track when John Hunter Nemec crashed in turn 3 with 3 laps to go and then held off teammates Chase Elliott and Kyle Larson after the final green flag. It marked the first 1-2-3 finish for any team in Martinsville's long history hosting stock car races. Larson rallied to finish second, Elliott third, Bubba Wallace fourth, and Ryan Blaney fifth. The race featured long green flag runs, with 2 of the 5 cautions pre-planned at the end of stages 1 and 2. There were 13 lead changes among 8 drivers. The victory was the 305th for Hendrick's teams, and its 29th at NASCAR's smallest, oldest track, a record for an organization at any venue. Geoff Bodine had the first one win at Martinsville on April 29, 1984. It convinced team owner Rick Hendrick not to fold his fledgling, struggling team. All 4 Hendrick's cars featured ruby red paint schemes, marking the anniversary. The Hendrick organization hosted more than 1,000 current and former employees for the race, but the owner was not able to attend, having recently undergone knee replacement surgery. Larson, the defending race winner and pole sitter, led all 80 laps in the first stage. Joey Logano gambled by taking right side tires only during pit stops after the stage and led the first 83 laps of green flag racing in the second stage before Denny Hamlin passed him to win the stage. Tough day. Christopher Bell, who began the race 6th in points and already with a victory, went 3 laps down early, gained 1 back after stage 2 stops, then spun out early in the final stage, bringing out the 4th caution. He finished 35th out of 37 drivers. Up next, the series moves across the country to Texas Motor Speedway, where drivers hope the repaved track will have cured some to allow for more passing since the repave. This next story is from the lifestyle section of the Monday paper. It's called Sunstar Pentas Take the Heat on Gardening. The early spring, at least in the South, has everyone drooling for new plants. The supply chain from producer to garden center somehow pulled off a miracle, and the supply has never looked better. The garden guy wants to urge everyone to also incorporate those flowers that will still be rocking come the hottest days of summer, which is usually August, and Sunstar Pentas are among the best. The butterflies and hummingbirds will be ever so grateful. Pentas, also called Egyptian star clusters, originate in Arabia and East Africa, and are related to Ixora and our beloved gardenia. The leaves are shiny and attractive, making for a great contrast with the star-shaped, colorful blossoms. In fact, the name Pentas comes from the Latin word for 5, because of the 5 floral petals. In 2020, the Sunstar Pentas series made their debut, and have piled up more than 60 awards. These are top performers and the Treasured Perfect Score Awards, and there are the elusive Flame Proof Awards from the Dallas Arboretum. These awards tell you right off you will be in the flower business until frost and feeding pollinators until the last hummingbirds head south. There are 4 colors in the Sunstar series: red, pink, rose, and lavender. They all get about 18 to 22 inches tall with around a 24-inch spread. They really perform best in fertile, well-drained soil in full sun. Prepare the bed by incorporating 3 to 4 inches of organic matter and till to a depth of 8 to 10 inches. While tilling, incorporate 2 pounds of a slow-release 12-6-6 fertilizer. No matter where you stand at my house, most would say I'm a little sun-challenged. That being said, my available sunlight seems to be just enough to give me beautiful flowers all summer. Sunstar Pentas are among the most carefree plants when it comes to maintenance. Making sure they have needed water is about all there is. The book says Pentas like a pH close to 7, but my slightly acidic condition has not proven detrimental. If you grow azaleas, camellias, or blueberries with ease, you might consider adding lime to your Pentas planting area. While preparing the soil, add 5 pounds of a pelletized lime per 100 square feet in sandy soil, or 10 pounds in a clay-based soil. When I post photos on Facebook, some followers always respond asking if my plants are in containers or in the ground. For some reason, my son's star pentas are always in the ground. They would definitely work in containers, but I am prone to put them in pollinator gardens with luscious latanias, Indian summer, or prairie sun rudbeckia, color-coded coneflowers, and various agastache. Everything about the Sunstar series of pentas makes you think they would also look incredible in a tropical setting with bananas, elephant cars, and cordyline or Hawaiian tea. You would be oh so right and will imagine the distant sounds of steel drums. One of the best traits I have discovered is deer resistance. I have been growing Sunstar pentas in a bed frequented by deer, and they have not been touched as of yet. I realize I probably just jinxed myself, but so far I am blissfully happy. You will be too if you add Sunstar pentas to this year's garden. And at the top of this story, there's a picture of the flower here. It looks just as they describe, with the shiny green leaves that are kind of in contrast to the bright pink colored flowers. Again, since this is a little bit of a shorter paper today, I'm going to flip back to the Saturday edition for the last couple of stories. This one is titled, Shop Still Putting Customers to Work. It's by Andrew Smith. Vinyl may be back, but longtime Canesville Collectibles owner Tim Behrens says it's not because of the medium. It's not the vinyl as much as the music, Behrens said. Music now is not very good, in my opinion. That's why the oldies stations do so well. His store sits at the corner of 4th and Story Streets in an unassuming brick building. If you've ever stepped foot inside, you know it's anything but plain. Built in 1910, Behrens now owns the entire building, which used to house an implement store, a downstairs bar, an AFL-CIO labor temple, and his father's antique store, Canesville Antiques. I kept seeing it every time I went by, but it's so covered with ivy, and I just wasn't sure it was really open, said Mary Lou Miller, a retired high school librarian. I decided to take a chance one time because the building just looks interesting. Behrens learned that during the building's use as a labor temple, unrest from a nearby crane accident brought action to the area. The bar was in session downstairs, and some non-union ruffians, or whatever you want to call them, came by and threw two sticks of dynamite and blew a hole in the roof, Behrens said. Canesville Collectibles opened in 1985 after the 68-year-old graduated from college and took over the space from his late father. Behrens pivoted the business from antiques to records, saying, "We have a few of those now." Behrens' collections of more than a million used records is piled in produce crates courtesy of the baker's grocery store by his home. Aisles at the front of the store are somewhat alphabetized and sorted by genre. As you walk in, you quickly realize how cavernous the shop really is. A book nook at the back and side rooms full of products present themselves as you go. That's all before you discover the stairs. Records downstairs start at $3, with many failing to pass the $5 mark. For an even greater value lie the sprawling upstairs rooms, some filled to almost unnavigable heights with hi-fi equipment and 12-inch records. The kicker? All albums found upstairs are $1 each. Anyone looking to start or significantly grow their own collection can get discounted rates by purchasing more than 100 or 500 records at a time. While the collection of vinyl records is arguably the biggest draw to Canesville Collectibles, Behrens keeps a respectable inventory of comics, books, compact discs, DVDs, and even some video games. I used to bring my boys down here, Chris Renstrom, a comic collector and longtime shopper, said. I pretty much come down here now just to check on the guys to see how they've been doing. When Cliff passed, I was really upset. Clifford Brandt, an employee of Canesville Collectibles for 33 years, passed away in 2021. Recently, Behrens has sought out extra help for cataloging and remodeling of the books section. Miller brought her tote bag along while she shopped the books in the back of the store. This is the first time I brought a bag with me. Mostly, I stack books by the door and then I come back. I grew up with all the records and CDs and all of that, but this is where my heart lies, Miller said. I disappear back in here for a while and then come out to spend money. Miller came in looking for books by science fiction and fantasy writer Andre Norton to no luck, but instead came away with a copy of Bill Malden's Army, a compilation of the World War II cartoonist's work. It's like suspense. What will I find? I have no idea. What am I looking for? I don't know. I'll know it when I see it, Miller said. The nonpareil asked if Behrens thought he'd ever sell through his inventory. You sound like my wife, Behrens said. She wants to travel, and I'm like, eh, okay. Behrens doesn't think his two children, three stepchildren, or grandchildren would want to eventually take over the business. Barring a good offer, he's committed to running the shop as long as he can. As long as I'm able, you know. If someone makes a nice offer, and I might consider selling, but I have a lot of inventory, so it'd have to be a substantial offer, Baron said. In the shop, Barron's gets to meet new people every day and visit with his devoted customer base. Sometimes someone famous stumbles in. One time I had a famous person in, and I didn't know who it was. I was relatively embarrassed, Barron said. I found out in the last year who it was, but if you don't talk to them and they're wearing a hat, how do you know who it is? It was Eric Clapton. Enough is never enough for Barron's, though, as he's currently on the lookout for more rock and roll and jazz records. Dubbed the Big One, Barron's and fellow vinyl aficionados are set to gather 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. Sunday for the Music and Collectors Show at the Omaha Firefighters Hall located at 6005 Grover Street. People from all over the Midwest get together and sell records and CDs, Barron's said about the event. Barron's is helping organize the Omaha event and has a box of cassette tapes ready to go for Sunday. The show costs $3 per person for general admission and $10 for early access at 9 a.m. Canesville Collectibles is open 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. Monday through Saturday. There's a couple pictures here with this story. The first one at the top is captioned, Tim Barron's, owner of Canesville Collectibles, poses on Wednesday, April 3rd, 2024, with a small selection out of his nearly a million vinyl records in store. He's got DVDs too. And there's a picture of Tim Barron standing there. He has his elbows propped up on two big stacks of records. And in the background, you can see hundreds of DVDs. He's wearing a shirt that says Canesville on the front of it. And his face, he's making an exhausted looking face while he's standing over his records. There's another picture here that's captioned, Tim Barron's, owner of Canesville Collectibles, tells Council Bluffs resident Mary Lou Miller about a new collection of Western books he had just purchased for the shop on Wednesday. And you can see Tim talking to the customer there, and in the background you see just piles and piles of books and records and DVDs. And that brings us to the end of today's reading of the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for Monday, April 8th, 2024. The Nonpareil can be heard every weekday at 5 p.m. I'm Fiona from Drake University in Des Moines. Thank you for sharing your time with IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind.